Coming up on this week's Redcast.
I think 20 years ago when I started in this field, there was a view that we could find the magic solution, that there would be a system we could implement, a GRC system. It was the start of the GRC. We could just make this magic system, and it didn't work.
The compliance function has moved from producers of thick documents to keepers of executable code.
The systemic process of compliance hasn't gotten enough support from technology. We need technology that understands text. It's a data architecture strategy for compliance.
It's a gap between IT if statement and regulatory text statement. There is a gap, and technology is able today to bridge the gap, but it's again not the magic button.
Part of the answer here is open source. It is getting this, the point where you can grab that artifact off the shelf, you know, a GitHub shelf, and say, this is what I need to solve that particular problem.
Especially even more on the business side, right? Client interaction, client prospect onboarding, everything is basically run through a tool. And I think therefore it has just become much, much more obvious. Why would we not simply connect the restrictions to these systems that are already there, right?
The pressure from the regulators is what makes this opportunity. And the more the regulators come and make clear what you have to do, that's what will allow this to happen.
Welcome to Redcast.
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 Redcast. Tomorrow's RegTech Radar today.
Hi, I'm PJ, CEO and founder of JWG. Here today to bring you Season 3, Episode 7 of RegCast. We're looking at unlocking embedding compliance and really looking forward to digging into the guts of this. Regardless of what part of the world you're in right now, your Reg Raiders have been hot. You know, summer in our hemisphere here in the UK has been very, very difficult on the continent, but also here in the UK, which has been freezing cold and wet for a solid month. That's given us lots of time to read what all the regulators are dropping on our doorstep as they run out for summer. It's everything from AI to quantum and all that in between. These rules are just the start of another huge wave of big regulatory reforms. But we're not here to discuss the details of ESG or new digital asset rules or derivative regulatory reporting. We wanted to step back today and reflect on the path forward for compliance overall. It's been quite a journey last decade, getting to the point we are now, trying to have controls that link back to policies that are tied to obligations. And the thinking around that has changed. JWG, in conjunction with APX and Ernst & Young, will shortly be publishing the results of our paper, which we interviewed dozens of compliance leaders and how firms have embraced the concepts of compliance and embedding them into part of their digital journeys. I want to highlight just three of the big findings today, and then I'm going to turn over to the esteemed panelists here we have to talk about some of them. But the first one is really about the nature of the compliance function itself. You know, really, the compliance function has moved from producers of thick documents to keepers of executable code. That's a really big shift. And it really helps facilitate one of the other big themes we came up with, which is that we're moving in reality from compliance being a noun to a verb. And the leaders are moving into rule repository mode where the controls are hooked to the front office systems or the things that people are touching so that they can actually get their hands on how do we make sure that the transactions are compliant. And that feeds into a third important observation I'd like to feed in today, which is this whole notion of the three lines of defense and how much longer that concept has shelf life. Operational compliance rules are moving into the business and enabling risk and audit functions to tap into the same kind of rule bases that are embedded for the front office. So why do we have this third line of defense? It's becoming a question hotter and hotter on the CIO's lips as he looks at his cost income ratio, his or her. Anyway, I'd like to, without further ado, I want the esteemed panels to introduce themselves. Ralph, can you, you look so relaxed. Can you come off of mute and just tell us a bit about yourself and don't refer to the fact you've been on the S word?
Not going to mention it. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot, PJ. Yes, I'm Rolf. I will call it a former legal and compliance specialist. I've been in the industry in legal and compliance for more than 20 years in the asset management and in the wealth management world. I'm doing what I today typically call traditional compliance. Traditional compliance, we'll probably touch upon the subject later. It's the thick documents, it's the PDFs, it's text interpretation, it's creating contracts, prospectuses, it's training employees in classroom, all that kind of stuff I've done for many, many years. And then 7 years ago, together with my fellow colleagues, we founded APX. APX, a company which helps our clients, financial industry clients, to digitize the regulatory requirements and, surprise, surprise, help them to really integrate and embed those compliance checks into business processes, right? So this is what we do today, and therefore, very happy to be here and share my views with you.
Thank you, Rolf. I'm really looking forward to the interaction between you and David. David, you're no stranger to RegCast, but why don't you introduce your perspective today and what great thing have you written recently?
Sure. So, background, I've been in the industry now since 2004, which is nearly 20 years, and I've been in operational risk, technology risk, information security, and compliance and legal, at a lot of banks, global, some of the top banks, smaller banks, everything in between. And I'm here in the personal capacity of having written a book called Stop Harming Customers, A Compliance Manifesto, which is coming out this fall. Final files are with the publisher this week. So that represents my my need to write down all of the frustrations. Oh, I'm gonna read a great quote that I saw in The Economist yesterday from James Baldwin. And then I head back over to you. James Baldwin apparently said, "The price one pays for pursuing any profession or calling is the intimate knowledge of its ugly side." So that's what I'm here for today.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for letting me read the early copy of your book, which people in my Saturday cafe were quite concerned that I was laughing too much while I was reading. I had never laughed so much doing it over a business book, and it is highly entertaining, and I'm sure all the audience will get a kick out of it. But let's kick this off now with Rolf. Really, in this paper that we spent months and months on and talking to tons of people, what did you take away about the future of the compliance function itself?
I think my main takeaway would be that I think most people we have spoken to, they agree that the compliance function, or let's not only focus always on the compliance function, but let's focus on compliance, right? How the financial industry is complying with all the regulatory restrictions and requirements, that this needs to change, right? I think that's probably the underlying statement that we hear from many, many different stakeholders. And I think what we also have been hearing and seeing is that at least some of the approaches seem to work, right? I think there are alternatives out there, let's call it making more sense out of compliance or dealing with compliance restrictions in a more meaningful, more efficient way. I think what we have seen in the context while establishing the paper are very concrete use cases and applications where this is actually working. Right, so that's not a theory, it's not an idea or something that hopefully is going to work in 20 years. It's something that has been implemented and has proven to be effective. I think that's great. On the other hand, I think at the same time, what we heard is it's never, let's say, a click of a button exercise, right? So I think we will be speaking about technology here today as well. We all use technology or use technology more and more in almost every aspect of our life. I think what we probably on the legal and compliance side underestimate is it's not a click of a button, right? It's not a sexy app that you download and then you click on it and then all problems are solved. It's hard work involved, but I think the important element is if the work that you involve, if you involve the work correctly, then there are big benefits that you can have afterwards, meaning you put resources into understanding the processes and mapping the restrictions and embedding them into a process, which helps then a lot afterwards. Is this an easy step? No, it's not, right? And I think that's what would probably be my summary from what we have been discussing with the different stakeholders, the interviews, right? From smaller companies, large companies, asset managers, banks, investment banks, wealth managers, basically everything. Would you agree?
So there's a theme there that this isn't new anymore. The people have actually done the hard work of embedding compliance into their digital journey.
I wouldn't say every financial institution has already done it. And this is, let's say, what every chief compliance officer would agree is the most efficient strategy. I don't think we're there yet. I think where we are right now is that from an idea, some, well, let's call it leading institutions, maybe in that space, right, they realized that resources should be invested differently maybe than what they have done in the past 10 years, 20 years, and that it has proven to work out. So I think,
yeah,
we're not there yet, but it's not a concept yet. I think we're in between, right? Leading firms have tested, proven value, and now I think it's for the broader community to understand what it is about, to learn from the mistakes the early adopters probably made as well, and then basically implement it in their own organization. But always, right, this is, as mentioned, I think that's important. It's not, there is no magic button involved here, although everyone would love the matching button. I would love it too.
Yeah. And David, when I read the draft of your book, you had these theses that formed a manifesto. Why did you frame it as a manifesto? I mean, I think of, you know, many different types of manifestos, but get what Ralph says. There's like a, you know, is there the urgency here? Is the community now at the point where they really need to go see what's nailed to the door that around the compliance function?
I mean, that was exactly the idea. The nailing, Martin Luther nailing his theses to the door, which led to a lot of catastrophe thereafter, I suppose. But the idea that it's, these are things we're all thinking, and I wanted to verbalize them. The process, the technology, I think 20 years ago when I started in this field, there was a view that we could find the magic solution, that there would be a system we could implement, a GRC system, the start of the GRC. We could just make this magic system and we'd put all our stuff in it and push a button and get the reports that gave all the data we needed. And it didn't work. And we found that people would just hide their data outside the system that they really needed, or it leading to inconsistencies in the central data, or that the data they needed was going to reside somewhere else. I can't get the balance sheet information into my GRC. It's never going to happen, but I need it. And endless attempts to make a taxonomy to rule them all inside every company, without the realization that different people need different data, and the same people sometimes need different data, different extracts of the same data on the same day. We need to interpret the data based on the use we're putting it to. And I see the rumblings of people talking about these things, and that's why I wanted to write the book, to have the place to have the discussion of, we keep just doing more of the same thing, which is, right, that's the definition of insanity. Yeah, in response to it not working, we just shout louder. So the point of my book is to bring it out.
But is that in part because of where we are, the technology cycle? You know, is it the cloud? Is it AI? Is it these new tools being more readily available?
So I love all of my compliance brethren. I think their understanding of the technology is always going to be a few steps behind other groups. It's not, they didn't go into the compliance for the technology. I think technology has let us down in the sense of the technology people not understanding compliance beyond, well, compliance is you need to know some rules and you've got to track people's gifts and entertainment, or you got to watch their email. The systemic process of compliance hasn't gotten enough support from technology. And I think the kind of technology we need, Ralph mentioned text, we need technology that understands text. And I think that the breakthroughs in AI, and especially in the consciousness about it, provide us a huge opportunity to not have to just keep employing more waves of compliance people.
So the question becomes quickly then, for your third thesis, it's the automation through data. What does it take to do that right?
It means acknowledging that it's not about making one system to put it all in. It's about what does the data mean and do I want to extract from it? Having the discussion about what am I going to use this for? What am I looking to produce so that we can have a data architecture, not a systems architecture, not find me a vendor, but what is the data architecture that compliance, what's this data architecture strategy for compliance? Mm-hmm. So we can say, one of my examples is we got asked by a regulator, what are all the regulations you have about font size? Small print regulations. It's in disclosures in capital markets. It's in consumer regulations around mortgages. It's in credit cards. It's everywhere. And then maybe it says small print. Maybe it says fine print. Maybe it says attempt to unfair deceptive acts. There's different ways of referring to the size of the print. And we had to produce that report. And how did we produce it? We made a PowerPoint. People called around and we did a bunch of work. And then nothing was tagged, nothing was stored about the data, so we lost it. And if you ever wanted to answer that question again, you'd do it all over. So, and it had been asked and answered apparently years before, but we couldn't reuse any of the data. So what I mean data strategy, I mean the ability to put metadata around any given piece of information in the firm and say, this is what it's about. This is what we used it for at some point in time. So we can go keep that knowledge.
Ralph, when you said earlier we underestimate how hard it is and it's not just a click of a button, were those the kind of things you had in mind?
Yes and no, right? I fully agree about, let's say, the data strategy and defining the taxonomy. I think where I would maybe slightly rephrase David's statements is, or at least based on our experience, right? I mean, I also haven't seen every bank in the world, but from the banks we are working with, I think where we see effective digitization of any kind of compliance requirement is actually if this is being led by a business initiative. So it's not a standalone legal, regulatory, or compliance exercise. And I fully appreciate, and I know there are many topics and many areas where this is the case, right? Where business does not take ownership. But those are probably the more difficult ones. I think we are often involved in making business processes more efficient, and more efficient in that case means including or embedding the compliance restrictions. And I think the benefit of starting with this angle is naturally senior management focus, it's budget, it's everyone being fully aligned on that subject area, because yes, you either want to sell more products or you meet more clients or you want to send your research documents to more prospects globally. Those are all naturally the activities every bank is doing, right? And you want to increase this, you want to increase revenue. So everything around client and prospect processes, be it from onboarding to selling, whatever it is, we see there actually much more activity. And it's obvious, right? Because there you can nicely create a business case before a project, right? No one, at least with the institutions we are working, right, they don't have millions of budget readily available to just spend on whatever regtech project, right? So you need to come up with a proper business case. Why would it make sense to spend $1 million here or $500K there, right? Why? And I think that's obviously very, very easy, or in most cases, very easy to justify if it's a business-related process, if clients are involved, if prospects are involved, or if employees are involved, right? So employees spending time on creating presentations and then searching for the disclaimers and the compliance team having to review the document or sending an investment proposal to a wealth management client, right? And relationship managers having to check every single investment product. Those are, I think, the areas where together with legal compliance, these things can be accelerated, right? Because you can easily explain there is an immediate impact, and the impact is not only compliance impact. I think, I mean, depending on to whom you would pitch such a proposal, right? I think to the head of wealth management, you would pitch more revenue, more client interaction, and less work for your relationship managers. To the head of compliance, you would pitch at the same time less failures, right? Less breaches, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the starting point, and I know, and you have many examples, David, right? I think the big reg change and reg mapping projects which started in the regulatory world of an institution, and appreciating, I mean, all of this was not done because it was simply an idea. I mean, regulators were asking for it, so you had to do it. But I think this is the more difficult side of the story, while the side I describe, the business side, if you can choose as an organization, and not every organization at any given point in time can choose, sometimes you have to do something. If you can choose, right, I would suggest, and we see more effectiveness starting on the business side, right? Because there is very obvious and rather immediate impact that you can generate. Still requiring what we have mentioned, right? Yes, taxonomies needing to be defined, mapping product data, client data. So all of this, absolutely, but less as a standalone regulatory project and more as an efficiency increase for the business process.
Yeah. And David, you've been at lots of places that haven't really worked out how to do this right. You know, do you see the structural approaches getting in the way? I mean, is it, if you try to come at, you know, the design of this big database and get all your laws and procedures,
yep,
and processes and control, is that just going to get in your way? And really what Ralph is saying is this the right way to go about it, which is be business centric, business case led.
So part of me believes that Ralph is right, and I cry inside, because yes, the value for the business needs to be there. And I see lots of point solutions. There's surveillance solutions, there's marketing review solutions, there's solutions for gifts and entertainment, there's solutions for AML. So there's lots of these, and they're good. But without the holistic one, we sort of boil the frog slowly. And the challenge I've witnessed is, and it is very hard to explain this and to get it through to management and to do it, is sure, you can start here, but I know as a very wise man I met at one of the banks said at 10 years ago, the kickoff of one of these projects, read the book, seen the movie, enjoyed the musical, everyone dies at the end. And I have watched these programs begin, and look, they're like the giant process mapping programs, all of the re-engineering programs back in the 80s. There have been all these attempts. And when they do work, the firms don't end up slowly building this huge object of risk management. I've watched these risk functions go from 50 people to 100 people to 5,000 people to 8,000 people, and then the firm doesn't know how to get out of it. Now we've got this huge infrastructure we're spending on, and now the business wants to go, I'd love to reduce this infrastructure. Like, you needed not to make it in the first place, because it's very hard to disassemble when you've created this interlocking three lines of defense that protects itself and builds this upon itself. And I've got audit checking compliance, and compliance checking the first line checking audit, and Jesus. So
I really loved your quote about Dante heading into the levels of hell, potentially through the risk assessment process.
How many assessments do we need?
Yeah.
So I hear what Ralph is saying. I think there is a bridge between business value and putting in some core infrastructure. Nobody wants to replace the heating and ventilation system in their house. That is not very sexy. Everybody wants to put a new car out in the driveway. But you can convince them. And the way to convince them is to show how, look, it's the regulators. The pressure from the regulators is what makes this opportunity. And the more the regulators come and make clear what you have to do, that's what will allow this to happen.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of ways, that's the whole impetus behind the common domain model.
Yes.
In terms of let's get on the same page, quite literally, so we can define the dictionary and the terms of the book that we're using to cut the contract, and then we can manage the life cycle of the trade. So when you and I are doing an FX swap that Ralph is a third party to, we can all define who's meant to report out the price for that particular instrument. It's really natty detail stuff like that where technology can really help.
Yes, and I think that model is the right model also of it. It can be bigger than any given firm. It doesn't need to be built inside. A lot of this could be infrastructure for the industry.
Yeah,
and I look at smaller banks, and I look at a firm like FIS or Fiserv. That's essentially what they're doing. They're providing that infrastructure on the marketing front end that goes to make money. They're providing the operational guts.
And there will never be one system to rule them all. That's a fallacy. Just like any 8,000 people internally will never kind of run the whole place either. But I think part of the answer here is open source. It is getting this the point where you can grab that artifact out off the shelf, a GitHub shelf, and say this is what I need to solve that particular problem.
Yeah. If there's any AI programmers listening to this, who knows if there are, I would love to talk to you. I got some NLP stuff I want to do with you.
Excellent. Ralph, tell us about how you think about these rule repositories and how you roll them out. Because I guess the question, you're never going to come top down across everything, but you're going to start one place. What do they mean to the people that have to then look at these rules as opposed to the PDFs?
Exactly. I think that's obviously one of the, let's say, difficult areas or challenges to be managed during such a project, right? I mean, I have been working in the regulatory space. I know regulatory people, right? And we are in contact with many of them who are still in such roles. And I think, but what I can say, and that's, I think, a neutral statement, that's nothing good or bad. I think the neutral statement is, yes, regulatory people like regulatory text, right? I think it's the exception, I would say, that a stakeholder from a legal compliance department would be super interested in taxonomies and the ontologies, and I mean, either has knowledge that's hardly there at all, and if you then introduce it, is there interest? Very little, I would say. Right? So yes, I think that's not something a normal legal and compliance regulatory person has a lot of interest in, and we just have to accept it. So we cannot change all those people, right? And that's also okay. I have understanding for this based on my education, right? I was educated with textbooks, regulations. We had to interpret for many, many years at university. I mean, that's why we are how we are. And I think that's just a fact. And the challenge then is, and I think that's then the challenge we would accept as a technology provider, and I think many technology providers do, you have to bring these worlds together, right? Because in such an integration project, whether this is now business focused or more generic for the whole organization, right? At some point in time, if you're aiming for an executable rule, right? The rule is not a text statement from a certain paragraph in a law, but it's actually a more technical if statement saying if this and this and that, then it's a no, or it requires an approval, or whatever it is. Those are two worlds, the regulatory world, and it's the technical, the IT world, right? Because someone in the organization at some point in time will take that rule, that executable rule, and will use it somewhere in in a system or technically in a process, right? So I think there's no way around bringing those worlds together. And this is something that today I would say is easily achievable. It's not straightforward. It's not absolutely straightforward because text is ambiguous, requires interpretation. And whenever we, in the past, right, we have done all those, let's say, rule definitions in the past 6-7 years, that was mostly done manually. Really, people reading, interpreting text, creating rules, and then having a bunch of governance and review and approval processes around to make sure that I'm the rule owner in an organization, right? I had a text statement before. Then you will receive from us whatever kind of a table format with the same rule, and I can compare and hopefully feel comfortable and approve. Now, with AI coming in, we are already using also extraction based on the very famous ChatGPT protocols, which are amazing. However, there is still, extracting a binary rule is still a challenge, right? Interpreting a text is amazing. Obtaining text information or text feedback of huge amounts of text is great. But really defining binary rules, that's still a challenge. And at the end, it's this whole governance and approval area, whether the rule is extracted manually or whether ChatGPT or any other AI algorithm is extracting an information. That's not APX, this is the technology provider of choice that can also be internal IT in a large organization. They need to be able to present that information in a meaningful format to the regulatory experts for review and approval. And I think that's the challenge that has been a challenge in the past. There are tools around to do this. This is absolutely possible, but it requires then the regulatory experts to engage. And the more similar the content is that they need to review and approve to what they're used to work with initially, the underlying regulatory laws and legal opinions, obviously the easier, right? So I think bridging this gap, it's a gap between IT, if statement, and regulatory text statement. There is a gap, and technology is able today to bridge the gap, but it's again not the magic button, right? It's not the magic button, do it for me and everything is okay. It's really case by case, topic by topic, use case by use case, country restriction by country restriction, review, approve. But once approved, I think then it's extremely powerful, right? If you have the if statement, I think we're maybe focusing a little bit too much on the cumbersome part of the process. This is the cumbersome part of the process, and I don't want to hide it, but I think once done, this is extremely
powerful. I actually want to disagree about what's cumbersome. That's okay. I think the cumbersome part of the process is the surrounding infrastructure. So if I think back to, I need to write a policy. I can write a policy. Your corporate policy on the cafeteria hours, I can write that, no problem. It's the approval and the checking and the auditing and all of the control reinforcement that a bank has to do to make sure the money doesn't get lost. It's all of that stuff that built around. Or if I'm writing some technology, I gotta integrate test it, I gotta back test it, I gotta validate it hasn't got any viruses, like all this other work around it. And for me, the value of the person is the knowledge, and that knowledge is the interpretation as it applies to my firm. How do I want to interpret this SEC rule on gifts and entertainment, or how do I want to, I've been at banks that take unfair deceptive acts kind of rules and say, well, we'll charge the fees this way. I've been at other banks that go, we're just going to stop charging fees. Yeah, problem gone. But it's not for those customers. We'll keep it for those customers because they're smart enough to not have done it. So that knowledge to turn the text into the set of rules that are my controls, I always want that to be with the person. And I think you're talking about technology, making that more effective. to give me that process so I can build those processes off the text and give me that lined up, here's what the rule said, here's what my control's doing automatically, and then give me all that testing of that automatically. Give me my policy, my procedure, my control, my whatever thing. Go find the evidence. Give me my metrics, because that's what I spend all my day on, going and collecting data from around the firm. And I don't have a search engine. I have Outlook. Who knows where the data is? Call up Mary. She knows where this is. Oh, Mary quit. Crap. Who's going to find this data for us? Well, we'll start over. Let's hire Ernst & Young.
Precisely. I think that the cost of creating these rules is not insignificant. And once you've got them, the cost of maintaining them can make the total business case very, very attractive. But it's all that embedded knowledge. It's in people's heads about what they're allowed to do in this country to show that. I think Ralph mentioned the disclaimer use case that's in the paper. But, you know, it's like, what am I allowed to put on the piece of paper that goes in front of that person? Is this something people spend a lot of time writing down?
That's what we need.
It's not necessarily even in the text, but it's like common practice and advice from a lawyer or an audit firm.
Let's get Mary's views on 12 CFR 1062 subparagraph B memorialized in Ralph's if statement. And then we don't have to do that again. We can go back and look at it.
Yeah.
As opposed to unearthing the Excel that she did that's on a SharePoint somewhere.
Yeah. So this means, and I think we've talked about the compliance technical discussion, but it also means the whole three lines of defense can change. Because if I can put the control in place, can I have the risk assessment of it done a lot easier?
Automate it. Have the data. We spend all our time collecting data. We spend 80% of our time collecting data and less than 20% actually digesting it, because we have to have meetings about the collection we just did.
Yeah.
So we never get to look at the data. And what comes back? A big page full of yellow, because everything averages out. And what did we learn? We didn't learn where the problems were. And by the time we learned about them, they've already happened.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, to your point, by moving them all these separate systems for controls and risks, they don't actually fit with the pace of the business.
And why do I have three lines? We don't have three lines of defense. We have like five. You've got audit, you've got some oversight functions, and oversight functions like compliance, providing oversight to other oversight functions like technology, and then the other way back. And you've got people who are in advisory functions in compliance who are call them 2A, and then you've got 2B people like me who are building systems and processes inside a compliance function. And then in the front line, you've got a control group, a 1B, and then a 1A.
Yeah.
And now we got five lines of defense.
Yeah. And I guess that's the real opportunity here is the efficiency. Even just as you say, having all the meetings about what people think the data is, it takes too long. So if you're able to get to embedded rules, then people can agree at least that the rule is what the data is as a basis of having the conversation.
Yes. And the solutions that Ralph is making allows that to happen so that you don't have to build all this stuff around it. I can just push a button to get the report once I've done the hard work of translating what the text means to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can focus on maintaining it and making sure that there isn't an update from the regulator on that particular point that you relied upon to write that if statement.
One more point on that. The sustainability is what everybody misses. So you get the regulatory finding where you want to kick something off. They start a project, somebody writes the response, but that's not the person who's going to be sitting in the chair doing that work 3 years from now. And the reality of maintaining this, whatever promises were made, is unsustainable.
Well, it's a fantastic point. That's exactly what most firms I speak to these days about their derivatives reporting are wrestling with. They've got great change the bank teams and doing some cracking analysis. But those, 170 workdays from now, those teams leave.
Yes.
And then who's going to be responsible for retrading all those conversations when a frequently asked question comes out?
Yes. And the process.
Let's not forget, like 10 years ago, they came out the day before Mira went live.
Right. And the process that they've created is, oh yeah, I take this spreadsheet, I mail it to somebody who then runs this macro with it, then yeah, that's going to work.
Yeah. So Ralph, this is all music to your ears. And just as we sort of move towards, you know, closing, I guess the big question I've got isn't the, you know, does this all make sense? I mean, it's obvious. It's a lot more efficient. It's a lot better, faster, cheaper, and safer. But why now?
I think there are multiple reasons, I would say. What surprises me still, to be honest, right? We have struggled quite a bit in the past few years, and personally also when I was still in the on the bank side of the street, right, with technology being really not there or super expensive within the bank to implement something, right? Even if you would buy a solution, let's say the software would cost you 50k, internal project to implement it is 500k, so business case is already dead before you start. So what we are seeing, and I think that's very, very interesting, a bit surprising to me, in the past, I would say 1 to 2 years, technology infrastructure within banks is becoming much more modern, right? If we ask an IT person today, is it a problem if for your travel management system, right, you would call an API, the API to check the rule, right? You have the rule in the repository. The travel system needs to be connected to the repository. You would do that through an API. So you ask an IT person, API connection, is this possible? Five, 6 years ago, question marks, libraries, impossible, all the infrastructure. I think this is really, really changing. So nowadays, I think we get so many more requests on using or accessing regulatory rules through an API that this is, it looks like, right? Maybe we are only talking to the very advanced financial institution, I don't know, but to the ones we're talking, this is possible, right? And coming up with the idea that why don't we simply integrate those checks in the travel management system before you actually travel, right? Before you apply for a trip. Let's implement this. Technically, it's an API. Yes, you need a rule. It's a bit of work to create it and prove it. So I think the adoption on the banking side, I think that has really changed. Not that you would hear that, right? At least I didn't hear it. There are no big four companies publishing papers that API economy and open banking is finally here. No, but as a matter of fact, if we speak to clients, that's really not a huge problem anymore, right? So I think that's one aspect of it. And the other aspect probably is also really looking at cost, right? We are in a, let's say, a bit more difficult environment, maybe compared to 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So efficiency is a topic again in many financial institutions, not all, but many. That's the other aspect, right? So there are efficiency gains. And then I think number three, I would say, which is basically an ongoing development since many, many years, is the fact that basically every banking process meanwhile has been digitized, right? If maybe not for the 50 employees and below banks, but large organizations, everything is digitized, right? Being internal processes, gifts and entertainment, personal trading approvals, and especially even more on the business side, right? Client interaction, client prospect onboarding, everything is basically run through a tool. And I think therefore it has just become much, much more obvious. Why would we not simply connect the restrictions to these systems that are already there, right? The systems were not built because of compliance requirements. They were built because of market demand, the client demand, and I want a fancy portfolio overview as a client or an online banking system with all the details. But now that the system is there and the clients are using it, well, we would be stupid as an organization not to attach as many items to the process to make it at the end more efficient. So I think I would say it's probably those three developments that I would see, right? Well, some of them being a bit more obvious, others like this acceptance of APIs, I think is a little bit more under the hood, but this is happening. And I think that's remarkable.
Excellent points. David, it's been 19 years into your compliance journey to get your theses ready. Why was 19 the magic number?
I kept doing it wrong. I kept also thinking that this seems like the obvious solution, and realizing after how deep and hard the problem is. This is not like these are not smart people who have been trying to solve these things for a long time. And we need to look at it as these are hard problems. The worst conversation I have is when somebody says, well, why don't we just buy this off the shelf? Because it's hard. This is the understanding is hard. It takes years to learn something. And that's the Dunning-Kruger saying, right? You think you're smarter than you are. You pick the guitar up and yeah, you think, well, I could play Madison Square Garden. What the hell's so hard about this? I got three chords. It's a complex, multifaceted. It's got legal, compliance, and technology issues. I think Ralph called me abnormal before because I'm getting my master's in computer science, and I don't know. I might be the only compliance person doing such a thing, which I don't know how smart that is. But he's right. It is understanding the confluence between technology and the law and how compliance works at a bank that is the challenge. And I think the new tools and what's happening on ChatGPT and things opens people's minds to what's possible so you can have the discussion. And I think that's a great opportunity.
Yeah, and I guess part of your thinking is framed by going to study technology right at the point where the ChatGPT hit the scene.
I'm taking natural language processing this fall. I've watched all the lectures, read the book a bit. I'm like, well, Jesus, we need some of this.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I guess in summary then, from my perspective, I think a lot of these themes echo what we've got in the paper, but it's the business. You know, 20 years ago when you started, David, was, F them, I'll take the fine. They're never going to find me anyway. These rules don't really, enforce those. And then we had a crisis, and then we had a bunch of regulation, and then we've had, people slowly realizing that the stuff they said they were doing wasn't what they did. And then we have another round of regulation, and then we have the expansion of regulation. But it all is getting much more detailed and dangerous if you're not paying attention to what those regulatory obligations mean to you. So, personal accountability and all that kind of stuff is starting to seep into the system. So I see it as a confluence of the type of agenda that you're on with the manifesto and that Ralph is on with the tooling. And then from a business perspective, realizing, we kind of really need to get on this. And you don't need to look very far to find half a dozen projects that you ought to be working on and doing in a better way. And let's face it, the folks you get around in the shop aren't getting any younger, and you've got to find a way to transfer this knowledge as we talked about earlier. So, to me, embedded compliance is the way forward. There's lots of different ways we can accelerate that. We look forward to speaking about that in future RegCasts. But for now, it leaves me to thank you, gentlemen, for contributing your time and expertise to this call. And we'll be getting back in touch with more on the radar very soon. Thank you for listening to this RegCast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review us on whatever platform you found us on. It helps others find us as well. Speak soon.
You can download the podcast via Spotify, Apple, and Google. But also, I'd encourage people to come to the JWG website, which, as hopefully you will know, is jwg-it.eu. Go to the Intelligence Hub and create your bespoke library.
This is RegCast.
Tomorrow's RegTech Radar today.